This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Good to have you with us. Ahead this hour, we'll get an in-depth look at the water crisis in Newark, New Jersey. Thousands of residents are relying on bottled water for the foreseeable future because of high lead levels found in water coming from the tap. Also, we'll check in with Falconer Eric Swanson to see if Ocean City's seagull experiment is working. Are Swanson's falcons successfully keeping aggressive gulls away from beachgoers and their food? But we begin on a much heavier note. We've asked Philadelphia City Controller Rebecca Reinhart to join us to address the police department's handling or alleged mishandling of sexual harassment complaints. Reinhart was here on the Roundup earlier this year to talk about her office's audit in 2018 of sexual harassment policies across the city. And we thought that in light of the resignation of Police Commissioner Richard Ross last week, we'd want to get her insight into what needs to happen to overhaul the work environment in the police department. Before we get underway, if you'd like to join the conversation, you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Rebecca Reinhart, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be on today.
So a brief recap. Richard Ross resigns last week as police commissioner. A lawsuit filed by two female members of the department alleges they were subjected to sexual harassment and retaliation by coworkers. And in particular, Corporal Audra McCowan charges that Ross refused to act on her complaints regarding the actions of another officer because McCowan had broken off an affair with Ross. Ross says he never retaliated against anyone. And Rebecca, on Thursday, you released a statement which said in part, "The reports regarding Richard Ross's resignation paint a concerning picture of issues we know to be deeply ingrained cultural problems in the city and specifically within the police department." So this alleged failing to protect members of the police department doesn't surprise you?
No, the overall issue does not. This specific instance, obviously, you know, I can't comment or don't know the validity of the claims, but overall, historically, there have been serious issues with how sexual harassment and misconduct claims are handled within the city at large and also within the police department. So the issue did not surprise me. Commissioner Ross's resignation did surprise me, I think, the way it surprised the rest of the city.
Sure.
But I, the issue itself is not surprising, unfortunately, because it really does need to be tackled in a more substantial way than it is being done right now.
Well, WHYY reporters took a look at court records and found that 9 female officers have sued the Philadelphia Police Department over sexual harassment or discrimination since the start of 2018, roughly, you know, maybe one lawsuit every other month. Why, Rebecca Reinhart, is the police department seemingly different in that its culture seems to be more vulnerable to or even accepting of sexual harassment than that of other departments? What are your observations?
Well, I actually think that there is a problem that goes beyond the police department in terms of how the city handles sexual misconduct claims. When you have a department like the police department, though, that is heavily male-dominated and is changing in terms of the number of women on the force, those are the departments we see more issues in. But the real issue is how the city addresses it. So right now, the claims are handled within the individual departments, which is not a best practice in any which way, so that each department has to often is in charge of investigating the claims within the department, which leads to many problems.
Well, in your statement last week, you say one of the most important recommendations from your 2018 audit, a full centralization of the reporting process, hasn't been implemented. Remind us of how centralization would work and how it would improve protection against something like sexual misconduct.
Sure. So the way it works, as I mentioned, the way it works right now is each of the over 40 departments in the city have the ability to investigate their own sexual harassment claims. So if you are a victim and you make a complaint, even if you make that complaint to the there is a centralized unit, but it's not true centralization in the mayor's office. Even if you make the complaint to that unit, it can be sent back to your own department to investigate. So what often happens is you have people investigating in the departments that know the alleged perpetrator. And often the alleged perpetrator is a senior manager. And that is not a best practice, because what you often get is either bias or pushing to make the complaints just go away rather than really addressing the issue in the department. So, and that's what the complaint actually says. The recent complaint against the police commissioner and others. It's important to know that Commissioner Ross was named in the suit, but so were many other senior ranking police officers, including the Christine Coulter, who was recently promoted to police commissioner for failing to take action when being told of these claims. So, what really needs to happen is for the whole process, from reporting to investigating to putting out discipline, all of that needs to be handled by a unit completely separate from all the departments. And that is a best practice.
You also write, Rebecca Reinhart, that if Mayor Kenney and his administration are serious about changing the culture, we need to deal with these specific cases as well as look to citywide reforms. And at the time of your audit last year, the administration had committed to making changes in the way sexual harassment complaints on city employees are handled. So implicit there, I mean, is, in your opinion, the administration serious enough or perhaps focused enough in getting the job done, the overhaul, and perhaps implementing centralization as you see fit?
At this time, I would say that no, they haven't been serious enough. When I first released the audit back in July 2018, the mayor's administration basically said that they were completely committed to this full centralization. And I was really hopeful at the time. But what I've seen since then is a lack of action around my recommendation, around the best practice. And it's been disappointing. I mean, I'm hopeful that perhaps this latest issue and losing a police commissioner that has, in many respects, done a very good job, Commissioner Ross, will hopefully be the push that the mayor's administration needs to make the needed changes, because it really does need this big of a change in how the complaints are handled. And in addition to that, there are a few cases that are very well known to the press and the public, yeah, and the city, that involve commanders in the police department that are still on the job. And those need to be dealt with as well.
Yeah, and the outgoing Philadelphia sheriff, Jewel Williams.
That's correct.
There's been a lot of money paid out, over $2 million in recent years. I mean, this is money the city can ill afford. I mean, which begs the question, would it be less expensive, in your opinion, to execute reforms?
Absolutely. I think that there would be money up front that would be needed to staff a centralized unit, but the return on investment would absolutely be there. I mean, that's the reason that I started looking into this issue back when I took office in January 2018, is the payouts, right? From a financial perspective, the city keeps making these payouts, but then doesn't seem to be addressing the structural problem of why we're making these payouts, which is because we're not handling sexual misconduct correctly. And there is a police commander that's still on the force today that the city paid out $1.25 million in December 2017 for a case of the commander alleged sexual assault of a subordinate police officer. So this needs to be dealt with, and it will save money. In addition to protecting our employees, it absolutely will save money.
Rebecca, have you had any personal conversations with the mayor on this recently?
Not recently. We had several conversations over the months that followed my release of the audit, where I expressed increasing frustration at the lack of true change. And that's really all I can say about it, yeah. is that I tried very, very hard to push him and to push the administration to make the changes. And look, they still can be done. They still can be. It absolutely needs to happen, though.
And again, insight as to why it hasn't happened yet.
I don't know. Mm. Of course, doing this is a substantial change.
Yeah.
And any type of change requires a lot of strength and energy and time to enact it. But other than that, there's no reason that's been given that makes sense to me. I've heard, oh, well, the departments should handle it themselves because then they can reform themselves. But to me, I think that the way to reform departments or change the culture is by having this unbiased outside unit that's handling it that then can come back to the department and say, this is what needs to be done here. And to guide the department heads and department senior leadership in this area. Just because you're a commissioner doesn't mean that you know how to handle sexual misconduct, right? You might be a great leader in all these ways, but not know how to do this. And so that's why I truly think that we need to have real change on the issue.
Rebecca, one more quick question before we let you go. Corporal Audra McCowan brought an alleged affair between her and former Commissioner Ross into play, as we mentioned earlier. She claimed retaliation. At this point, consensual relationships between city workers do not violate any policies, correct?
That is correct, and that was one of the recommendations that came out of my audit as well, that there should be a policy around consensual relations and regarding what needs to happen. But I think the fire department is the only department that has a policy on that right now. So that was another recommendation that, to my knowledge, has not been implemented at this point.
Especially, you know, since some go bad and you know, this can affect the workplace and you know, and perhaps a closer look is necessary at those between higher-ups and subordinates.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the best practice in that situation is, and I think most people know this, that work in different industries, that once, if there a relationship does develop, you're supposed to tell senior leaders in your department or in your unit quickly, and then there's supposed to be a transfer, right? I mean, that's what, so that there isn't a direct reporting relationship. But that hasn't happened yet at the city.
All right. Rebecca Reinhart, thanks as always for joining us here on Radio Times. We'll be in touch, I'm sure, down the road on this issue.
Oh, it's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Rebecca Reinhart is controller for the City of Philadelphia. Up next, Newark's water crisis regarding lead. Stay with us. This is WHYY in Philadelphia, Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Imagine that as a parent, you're about to hand your child a glass of water, but you're not certain the water is completely safe to drink. There are concerns that water coming out of the tap might contain high levels of lead. The government has provided filters, but there's word the filters might not be working properly. And even though bottled water is now being made available, the process of accessing enough clean, safe water for a growing family is an unrelenting stressor because water is used for just about everything. This is real life for thousands of people who live 85 miles northeast of Philadelphia in Newark, New Jersey. Karen Yee has been reporting extensively on this for NJ.com and the Star Ledger, and she joins us now on Radio Times. Welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
So, Karen, the story begins in 2017 when there was an issue with corrosion control at a water treatment plant serving the western part of Newark. Do I have that right?
That's correct. So lead levels began to spike in the city in early 2017, and the city is served by two water treatment plants. So the one that serves the western side and also provides water to several surrounding towns, there's a treatment called corrosion control. And what that means is there's these chemicals that are put in the water, and as they flow through pipes, they're supposed to create a protective barrier to prevent lead pipes from flaking off into the water. And that treatment failed. So what happened is you have 18,000 of these old pipes throughout the city that are snaking underground, and lead is dissolving into that water and coming out of the tap. And you have the same thing happening in some of the surrounding towns that also buy their water from Newark.
Okay, so lead levels spike. Karen Yee, do we know to what levels, and were those levels considered to be dangerous?
There is no safe level of lead that's been established, but the federal government sets a threshold of 15 parts per billion. So the way sampling works is different water systems have to sample every couple of months, every year, depending on how big the system is. And in Newark, if more than 10% of the samples are over this federal threshold, which is 15 parts per billion, then you have a problem. Then you have to inform the public and you have to take action. And that's what happened in Newark. 2017, at the end of 2017, and you've just sort of seen the lead levels continue to rise since then. And so now we're almost 3 years in, and the lead levels are still over that allowable federal limit.
Who is most vulnerable to elevated levels of lead?
Children. Lead is known to, it's a contaminant that has no color, it has no smell, so it's sort of hard to spot. But it affects cognition and behavior, particularly for young children under 6 years old. Also, pregnant women, it could affect the development of their child. And so those are the populations that the city is really trying to target and trying to say, listen, we're not sure whether this sort of short-term measure we put out, these filters, are working. Until we figure that out, please use bottled water to drink and cook. And so they're really targeting young families, pregnant and nursing women, and the elderly as well.
Karen Yee, as you reported, the city of Newark, New Jersey, spent many months last year assuring residents that this issue was confined to a small number of homes when officials knew otherwise?
That's correct. So when the lead level started to spike in 2017, and in 2018, this really ramped up because the Natural Resources Defense Council, which is a water advocacy group, they sued in Flint, Michigan, and they came to Newark and they started raising flags about the lead levels here. And at that point, the city got defensive and they said, listen, our water is safe. There was a robocall that went out. There was an annual brochure that tells people about the water, and they said the water is safe. You know, so what the mayor has said in defense of that is that he was trying to make the distinction between source water and tap water. And the source water is safe, and that is true. You know, the problem here is old infrastructure, and that's where the lead is coming from. So he's defended that statement by saying that he was trying to ensure residents that it wasn't coming from the reservoir, that the reservoir water was safe, that it was a treatment and it was an infrastructure issue. And at that point, you know, he was saying that this was confined to a few old homes, a couple dozen, and he said that he didn't realize it was a widespread problem until later on. And it is a widespread problem because it's not just a few old homes, it's treatment. It's treatment that is being pumped to thousands of homes in Newark and outside of the city.
Well, what are you hearing from residents? I mean, guessing is there a level of distrust here, especially since, at least perhaps to them, Newark officials were not immediately on the up and up regarding the extent of the crisis?
There's definitely a lot of frustration and a lot of panic and confusion. You know, what's prompting that, I think, is the bottled water distribution, right? You know, they've been hearing about water issues for the last couple of years. The city saying it's safe, then they pass out filters, then they're passing out bottled water. So they're not really sure what's going on at this point. They're worried. What have they been drinking for the last couple of years? Should they have taken more precautions? I waited in line with a couple of the residents picking up bottled water in the summer heat, and they're just trying to figure out what have I been drinking, not just for their children and maybe for their parents, but for themselves as well. So there's definitely a growing panic, and I think it's important and the city's been trying to educate residents about, you know, what they can and can't use the water for. So, you know, it's only for cooking and for drinking that you need the bottled water, but you can still shower with it. You can still wash your laundry with it.
Out of the tap, you mean, or out of the regular
lines.
Correct, yes. Are children being tested for lead in Newark, New Jersey?
Yes, the city offers blood lead testing for children. A lot of hospitals have also stepped up here to offer free testing for everyone in the city. And there's also testing going on of the water at this point, because that's sort of the surefire way to know if there's lead in your tap. Just get a test done. And so the city offers free testing for that. There's other companies here that are also joining the effort. So a lot of people are jumping in on this and trying to help out and trying to give out accurate information so people can understand what's going on with their water.
And Karen Yee, have we heard back yet about how children in the affected areas are doing? Do we find that large numbers, small numbers, some kids are experiencing high levels of lead in their bloodstreams?
The problem with getting those blood level results back and making a direct link to the water is that, you know, Newark is an old city, and lead is also found in paint, lead dust. There's multiple ways that children can be exposed to lead. So even if a child comes back with blood lead levels over the limit, over what's allowable, it's hard to pinpoint and say that definitely came from the tap water, because, you know, the schools also had a lead issue back in 2016, and they handled that within a year, and they were, you know, they also gave out bottled water and were aggressive to change out old lead fixtures. But there's so much lead in the environment that it's hard to know, you know, where exactly the contaminant is coming from. Mm-hmm. I spoke to one mom just last week, and she has lead paint in her home that still has not been abated by her landlord. Her child went to an elementary school that had lead in the schools, where they shut down the water fountain in 2016. And she's also a resident who has a lead service line, you know, these old lead pipes that are causing the problem in her home. So there's lead wherever she looks, and that's really concerning to her as a parent.
And many of these residents do not have the means to leave, to pick up and move elsewhere.
Exactly. They can't afford that.
So, as you mentioned a short time ago, you know, water filters were handed out, bottled water. Let's get to the water filters first. I think thousands were given out to residents, but Karen, now there are questions about whether some of these filters are working.
39,000 filters were given out to residents, and these are the filters that screw onto your faucet and also are pitcher filters, and these are certified nationally to remove lead from the water. And these are used across the country. These were used in Flint and were found to be effective in most cases. And so that's really what triggered this alarm this month in this mass bottled water distribution program, because the city, at the request of the state, tested three homes. They tested three homes post-filtration. And normally that's not something that's required. When you're testing for lead, you're testing without filters because you're trying to get a true sense of how much lead is in that tap water. But in this case, they said, well, let's see if our new treatment is working. Let's see if these filters are working. Let's test the small sample size. And what they found was really disturbing, because two of the three homes, post-filtration, so after the water was going through these filters that are supposed to absorb the lead and make it safe to drink, they found that lead levels remained high. It did absorb some lead, but it did not absorb the amount of lead that it should have been absorbing. And so that sent off, you know, a lot of alarm across the state and the EPA, which prompted the EPA to say, listen, we need to distribute bottled water in here until we figure out what is going on. Is this a defect of these two filters? Is this a more of a widespread problem? We don't really know. And that's I think, what's causing a lot of confusion.
And so then to the bottled water distribution, you know, noteworthy, at one point the distribution came to a halt because some of the bottles were past their best buy dates. And there was you know, some upset, of course, regarding that. Although, you know, if it's past best buy, that doesn't necessarily mean the water is unsafe to drink.
Right. The waters were past the date, but water doesn't expire. So it was okay to drink, but again, it sort of fueled that distrust, you know, from the public. They're not sure which messaging to listen to, and now the water is also past its best buy date. So now a lot of people that I spoke to said, well, I'm going to try and find my own water. I don't know that I want to pick up that water. So it just sort of fueled this increasing panic in the city. So this happened. The state gave Newark about 20,000 cases of water. Those were past the best buy date of May 2019. And then by Tuesday night into Wednesday, the state issued another 70,000 cases of bottled water to the city. So the city resumed the distribution at four centers. And there's been a lot of other groups that have been collecting bottled water, churches, nonprofits, You know, people email me every day saying, how can I contribute? At this point, like I explained earlier, there's only the residents that live in the western side of the city, mm-hmm. which is that are served by the Pequannock treatment, are eligible for bottled water. So that leaves residents in the east part of the city saying, well, should we be buying bottled water too? And so a lot of those residents aren't technically eligible, but the city has made an exception if you're a pregnant mom or nursing, that they'll give you water just to sort of calm some of the fears out there.
Well, I did want to get to that because, as you mentioned earlier in the show, that the city is served by two different treatment plants. There's Pequannock, which serves the part of the city which is, you know, under question about the high levels. And there's Wanacue, correct, which serves
correct.
The eastern part of the city. And residents there are saying, okay, maybe we need to have bottled water as well. Karen Yee, has it been confirmed that there are issues with the water coming from the Wanacue plant? Or is it just people questioning whether they need to be included?
Right. So in Newark, both systems are run by different authorities. They take water from different water sources and they have used different water treatments. But in Newark, they're regulated. In New Jersey, they're regulated as one system. So Newark as a system has elevated lead levels. But when you boil down to it, it's really only the Pequannock treatment, the western side of the city, that had a treatment problem. And the treatment problem caused the infrastructure to be a problem. On the eastern side, you don't have a treatment problem, but you still have some homes where there are elevated lead levels. And that's, you know, it could be because you have a lead fixture, you know, lead solder, something in your home that's triggering that. But on an isolated case, you're not seeing lead levels that are above that federal threshold that sort of should trigger concern. Yeah. So you are seeing some elevated lead levels in some homes, but nothing on a widespread or systemic issue at this point.
How has Newark, New Jersey Mayor Ross Baraka responded to the crisis, Karen?
Well, recently, you know, he's currently holding a press conference. They're announcing a plan to expedite one of the city's long-term solutions. So since we found out there was lead in the water, and since the city acknowledged that this was a widespread problem, it was not just a few homes, they've rolled out two long-term solutions. One is to change the treatment, make this corrosion control work for the pipes. And the second is just eliminate the source of lead, and that is the pipes. Both solutions are not a quick fix. The pipes were a $75 million program supposed to take 8 years to a decade to fix. Mm-hmm. The treatment started in May. It won't be felt, you know, treatment takes a while to sort of coat the pipes and work, up to a year to work. Today, county officials and state officials, in conjunction with the city and the mayor, are announcing an infusion of cash, $120 million, to speed up this lead replacement program to about 24 to 30 months. And so that's going to cut down a significant amount of time of how quickly this can be fixed.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, then the treatment program that is in place now takes quite a while to actually become effective in reducing lead from water. And this new proposal, would it switch out the treatment program completely, or have they released details on that yet?
The new treatment program, they started that in May. And yes, they're basically changing the chemicals that they're putting in the water. It's the same chemicals that are used on the eastern side in the Wanacue treatment plant. Those chemicals will now be used in the Pequannock treatment plant.
And those chemicals then, they actually help to reduce the amount of lead in water.
What they do is they as they flow through the pipes, they create a protective barrier to prevent lead from going into the pipes.
So moving forward then, is this changing? I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. Do we know if they're changing this process to make it more effective and more effective more quickly?
Yes, the treatment has changed. They changed the treatment earlier this year. The problem is it's kind of a wait-and-see approach, right? The chemicals don't take effect right away. And so in the meantime, the filters were supposed to be the stopgap measure, the short-term, you know, while we switch out the pipes, while we wait for this treatment to work, use these filters. And so that's what's causing the panic, because now they're saying, well, we're not sure yet whether these filters are working as they should.
Okay, so what I'm trying to get at is the $120 million bond program, it's a long-term solution, I guess, to try to fast-track the overhauling of the lead crisis. Okay, so we're not changing the treatment at the water plants. We're just fast-tracking with the $120
million. The $120 million will fast-track the lead pipe replacement.
Okay.
So that it'll give the city money up front, so they'll be able to hire more contractors to, you know, dig into the ground, pull out these pipes. These are kind of garden hose size pipes that connect from underground water mains to homes and replace it with copper.
Okay.
So they have to, it's about $10,000 for each pipe. So they have to go in there, dig it up, take it out, replace it, and then eliminate the source of the lead.
And in the meantime, residents of Newark kind of have to sit tight, at least those affected by this, sit tight and use bottled water until this is resolved.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
We have an email from Cynthia. This is a direct reflection of the crumbling infrastructure in our country. I'm willing to bet this is happening throughout the nation. We really need to get serious about investing in this problem before we have a national crisis. I think you alluded to this earlier, Karen Yee, in that, you know, many people, especially in older homes, have lead solder in pipes. And you know, there's lead that is present in the home. And this is up to homeowners to handle repairs, not necessarily state or city agencies, correct?
That's correct. And even in Newark, you know, the 18,000 lead service lines that we keep talking about, those are technically owned by the homeowner. And so the city created a partnership with the state to be able to pay up to 90% of those costs. And even the 10%, which is up to $1,000, is a lot for a homeowner to afford.
Sure.
And that's not taking into account exactly what you said, you know, other indoor lead plumbing fixture, lead fixtures that could already be in the home. And that's going to be entirely up to the homeowner. And lead service lines exist throughout the country and throughout the state. And, you know, it is a huge infrastructure problem that cities and states need to take seriously before it sort of reaches this crisis level, right, before it becomes a problem.
Karen, just one quick question. We've got about 20 seconds left. Democratic State Assemblyman Jamel Hawley wanted a state of emergency and a state takeover of the Newark system, but clergy leaders in the city are saying not so fast.
Right. We asked Governor Murphy about that directly. He said, not at this time. We're not going to declare a state of emergency. He said, we'll declare one when we feel like we've reached our capabilities and you know, we need to. And they're not at this point at this time.
Karen Yee, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Karen is a journalist covering Newark, New Jersey for NJ.com and the Star Ledger. Just ahead, to wrap up the show, we visit Ocean City and talk to Falconer Eric Swanson about a little experiment Ocean City's been doing to try to ward off marauding seagulls by using falcons. Let's see if it works. We'll find out in just a couple moments. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. A couple of years ago, I was walking alongside my niece on the boardwalk in Ocean City, New Jersey, when all of a sudden a seagull swooped down from behind and flew between us to grab the scoop of ice cream from her cone. We were more surprised than angry, astonished at this nimble bit of thievery. And of course, we're not alone. Seems like everyone has a story about New Jersey seagulls. So when we saw that Ocean City was trying a new tack in its war against the marauders, we thought, okay, let's sit back to see if this works. Will trained falcons be able to keep seagulls at bay? Turns out the answer is yes. If you have a story, we'd love to hear it. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Here with us now to help us take a, pardon the terrible pun, deep dive into the issue is Eric Swanson, owner of East Coast Falcons, which is the company employed by Ocean City. Eric, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So Ocean City, New Jersey, how did you come to bring your falcons to this this family-friendly Jersey shore town? Did officials call to say to you, we are at a breaking point? I mean, what did they say?
Yes, they were at a breaking point, actually. They called us in and told us we're not allowed to leave.
So that, but this is after the experiment. Let's talk about how this all rolled out, this summer. The story I just told of the seagull obviously is something that, you know, people have experienced similar. So you bring your birds. Let's talk about what you bring to the store, to the shore. We talked about falcons, but it's not just falcons that you work with. You work with owls as well. Is that it?
Well, we have a falcon, four hawks, and an owl. And the falcon covers the morning shift. The hawks cover the afternoon shift when it's the hottest. And then the owl covers the evening shift.
Okay. And so when you go out, are you spread across the entire boardwalk, and how many birds are working at a time?
We fly one bird at a time. The falcon will cover the whole island. She goes up nice and high. The hawks cover the whole beach and the boardwalk, and basically just chase the birds away.
They don't kill the seagulls.
No, it's not that kind of a program. We're actually flying our birds a little out of hunting conditions, so they're willing to chase, but they're not willing to commit to, you know, killing anything. And that's what we want to do. There's no reason to have hawks running in there and killing seagulls at a family entertainment place.
Yeah, that was one of my questions initially when I read the story. So, they don't kill the seagulls. In the wild, is a seagull a potential dinner for a falcon?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So these falcons exercise a little bit of restraint, I gather. Do you feed them before you send them out?
Yeah, they get a little bit of food. They're a little bit high, or what we call high in weight. So any raptor would have to be in hunting condition, which is a state of perfect physical fitness along with hunger in order to commit to a kill. So any raptor would not want to make a kill before that. So that's where we're flying them. It's not that they couldn't do it if they decided to. We've been lucky that it just hasn't happened yet.
Hmm. So, Eric, when you first brought the falcons out onto the beach, what was the reaction from the gulls?
Terror. Anytime you bring a raptor around any other bird, there's, you know, extreme terror. This is a bird that could come in and eat you. So we had a pretty much of an immediate reaction of the gulls flying off, not wanting to be there, running out to the ocean where they're safe, or the bay, and with full coverage, and coverage is pretty rough for our falconers. They're working from 10 a.m. to 11 at night to keep the gulls at bay, flying on the boardwalk and along the beach and throughout the interior of Ocean City.
So you have one bird, say, in one section, and a whole flock of seagulls all of a sudden deciding to take off for the ocean.
Yeah, that's pretty much what they do. They fly out to the ocean, or they fly above the raptor where they're safe. Raptors can come down at great speed, but getting up is pretty hard. So they usually avoid trying to chase a bird up and up and up. And seagulls are extremely good flyers, so the raptor needs a little bit of an edge to catch them.
And seagulls normally would feed from the ocean, correct? They're you know, French fries, obviously not a part of the natural diet.
Well, they are actually feeding from the ocean now. We had a resident of 20 years that told us this is the first time he saw the gulls actually fishing. And the diet of French fries, the reason they're doing it is because it's a nice, easy meal. They don't have to work for it. Now they have to work again.
We have a comment from Elle, who says seagulls are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Isn't sending falcons to disrupt their habitat violating the act? Have you run into this, Eric Swanson?
Sure, but the federal government issues a permit called an abatement permit, which allows us to chase birds. And again, with that permit, we're not looking to hurt the birds. We're just harassing and chasing them. And it's just to keep them off the boardwalk, to keep them out of a bad diet of French fries and funnel cake. It's not a good diet for a seagull. It'll actually hurt them. Mm-hmm. And we're just pushing them off. That permit does allow us, if a bird got killed, we would be okay and not violate that the MBTA.
Yeah. Well, and so do you need to be out there every single day? Or the gulls, my understanding is seagulls are fairly intelligent birds, so you have to be a presence every day for them to stay away? Or how does that work?
They're very intelligent birds, and they try every angle they can think of to outsmart you.
What have they tried with you?
they'll come in from the back. When you're at one end of the boardwalk, they'll try to rush the other. So our falconers have to run down to the other end of the boardwalk. It's a constant battle. Every time you think you got them, they try something else, and you need to outthink them to get down there with your bird. They're very, very intelligent.
So, Eric, when you're working with people who happen to be vacationing, walking along the boardwalk, you know, maybe having an ice cream or eating some fries, what are you hearing from them?
They love it. We do have, of course, the occasional naysayer that, you know, leave the seagull alone. And with education, you know, they begin to understand the program and may not like it, but they, you know, accept it. And they realize that, no, we're not out there killing seagulls all willy-nilly. But I would say 99% of the people we talk to, they love it. We actually get completely swarmed when our falconers are flying the birds. They actually get standing ovations from the people. Everybody seems to love the program. We have people eating their food in peace along the boardwalk. And it's working very, very well.
So when the bird is with you on the boardwalk and people are coming around, how does that interaction work? Do they not get too close to you? Are you able to hold the bird for a little bit and talk about the bird to educate people as to how the falcons work?
Yes, we do a lot of that. No, people are not allowed to touch the bird. We keep the bird at a distance. We don't want anybody getting grabbed by a bird or bit by a bird. Which could happen, and that's why we don't let them interact with the bird. But yes, they ask millions of questions. We actually get completely swamped, sometimes to the point where it's hard to move through the crowd. But everybody's interested in the program. They all want to see the birds. When the people see the birds flying, they absolutely love it. When we're on the ground with the birds, before we fly, they come in and have a million questions.
I noticed in a picture, Eric Swanson, that's published of your falcon crew, that while they're waiting the call to work at the beach, they were sitting in a van with head coverings on, their eyes were covered. Does this help the falcon to stay calm?
Yeah, that's what we call a hood. It's a, you know, it's a tool that's been used since the beginning of falconry. Raptors, except the owl, all live in a visual world. So once you take their vision away, nothing can hurt them. They just kind of calm down, sometimes go to sleep. It's dark. And it's just used to anything that would normally bother them. If they can't see it, it doesn't bother them.
It is an ancient sport. Tell us more about falconry.
Oh, falconry has been practiced. It seems like my understanding of it, the earliest writings were about 5,000 years before Christ, somewhere in China-Mongolia area. It's spread across the world at that time when there were no guns as a means of procuring meat. It broke in England in the UK as a very, very popular sport. It was kind of set to nobles where they would practice falconry. It's, you know, stayed around. It's practiced in the United States or all across the world now to a lesser degree, more for sport than, you know, as a way to procure food. Yeah. It's much easier with a gun. Falcons, you're stuck with them all year long. You have to feed them all year long, take care of them all year long, fly them all year long. So it's a very demanding sport.
Well, how did you get into it?
I actually ended up working at a zoo. I was asked if I could, as an animal trainer for training livestock, to stand still for veterinarian procedures. At that time, if you knock down an animal with chemical restraints, there was a high mortality rate. So they wanted animals that could be trained to stand still for veterinarian procedures, large livestock like bison and stuff like that, elk, you know, cats, very dangerous to work with. So we were working with that when the curator of the zoo asked me, could you train that eagle? It just sits there. And I said, yes, I think so, and started reading up on it. First bird I trained was an eagle. It worked out well. I fell in love with it and have never looked back and have been training birds ever since.
How do you train a falcon to chase a seagull? Do you start with, and not to hurt it, do you start with a very young bird? And what does the training process look like?
No, again, so the physical fitness of a bird. So in order for a bird to hunt, it has to have an extreme physical fitness. And then it needs hunger along with that. So what we're doing is basically just removing the hunger part. Now, the bird at that time, it's still a raptor, and it will chase a seagull, but it may not commit to the kill. So as it's chasing the seagull is running and screaming, and, oh, my God, I'm about to get eaten. And as the falcon gets close to it, it just simply peels off and, I'm not ready to eat right now.
Okay.
You know, maybe I'll come back when I'm a little hungrier and eat you.
And Eric, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, there are people, you know, who are fans of seagulls. And in defense of seagulls, James Gorman wrote a piece in the New York Times last week. And in it, he talks to ornithologists who point out, you know, well, first of all, we mentioned this, humans leave food lying around. So it's not necessarily, you know, the gull's fault in that they go for it. But they're really smart. They're great parents, seagulls are. They co-parent. They're really good at surviving in a sometimes hostile world. What is your personal feeling about gulls?
We love them. They're so intelligent. They're, you know, extreme survivors, yes. Everything about them, actually working with gulls, sometimes it's the greatest challenge. It's a lot of fun. They try every little angle they can find. They test you. They want to see what you can do. We're big fans of gulls. And again, we're not looking to hurt them. We're just looking to push them off the boardwalk and the area for the tourists during that time. Once that's done, they're welcome to come back.
So I noticed in pictures, you know, when you're handling the gulls, you've got, it looks like, really thick gloves, guessing leather. Have you been injured at times in training gulls and working with them? And what do you do to protect yourself if so?
Well, falcons have very sharp claws, so that's what that glove is for. Training the birds, you know, they can hurt you. If you didn't have that glove there, you'd bleed all the time. Actually, a lot of times when we're doing these kind of things, the falcons, you know, accidentally scratch you. You know, once they're trained, they're pretty good. They don't bite you, you know, as much as when you first start training them. It's just a protection for, you know, from their nails or talons and their beak.
How, you know, trying to get into the head of a falcon here, how do you think your birds of prey regard you? What are you to them?
A source of food. Birds of prey really don't make a connection like a dog or a cat. There is a connection there, but it's not as strong as a regular house pet, and that's why they're not pets. They are hunting birds. What we're doing with abatement is augmenting the way that they're flown. Any of the birds, if you were to take them and bring them into that, you know, that high physical fitness and, give them a little bit of a hunger, yeah, they will hunt for you. Mm. But what we're doing here is not hunting. We're doing bird abatement. We're just, you know, chasing away gulls. We're making it more pleasurable for the people that go to Ocean County. And it's actually funny when we explain this to people, they go, well, why don't you just kill them? We hate them. You know, and and again, that's where the education comes in. It's when we tell them there's no reason to hate them. They're actually really nice. We love them.
And it wouldn't enhance the experience at the beach with your family if they're actually truly hunting the seagulls. That would be rather disturbing, I'm sure. Early days, very quickly, think you'll be back next year to Ocean City?
It sounds that way, but that's up to the mayor and the, you know, the council, and if they want to spend the money.
Okay, Eric Swanson, thank you so much for joining us. Eric Swanson is owner of East Coast Falcons. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks for listening to Radio Times.